Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present, of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh yeah.
Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
You're on 3CR Tuesday Breakfast. My name is Sviza, and this is a summer special episode we have curated from highlights of our show from 2025. This episode, we are looking back at speeches and chats focusing on the theme of global solidarity with the diaspora, featuring voices from the Philippines, Sri Lanka, Singapore, and more. 3CR Tuesday Breakfast will be back to our regular program format next week. Till then, stay tuned to 3CR Community Radio. Up next, we're going to have Nez Gabanzo from Gabriela, Australia, a Filipino women's grassroots organization that advocates for women and children's rights. Its main advocacy is the prevention of domestic and family violence, and today she will be speaking to us about the work her organization does, as well as their upcoming event in conjunction with International Working Women's Day. Good morning, Nez. Can you hear me?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, Nez. How are you today?
Good.
Good. It's so good to hear from you. Can you tell us a bit more? I mean, I briefly outlined it, but yeah, tell us more about your organization and how it came about.
Yeah, so our organization is actually an overseas chapter of Gabriela Philippines that was founded in 1984. The one here in Australia was founded in 1996. So basically, in the Philippines, Gabriela Philippines is the largest alliance of women's grassroots organizations. So it's composed of hundreds of women's organizations. Yeah, so the main purpose is the same, for the protection of women's and children's rights.
It's incredible. And obviously, your focus is very much on Filipino women's, but there's a lot of very, very close ties to, obviously, the women in the Philippines as well. So could you share a bit more about, you're obviously over here in NAM, but what do you see the role of advocating for Filipino women both here and back home?
I think it's always important to investigate everything in terms of the roots of oppression, also from the home country, what is happening, because at the end of the day, we are a lot of us are economic migrants. We were forced to migrate because of poverty, corruption, and the overall, you know, structural violence that is happening at home. And then when we get here, we also get to experience that alongside with other migrants from, you know, different nationalities. And we do extend our services to those to non-Filipinos. Yeah, yes. But we are 100% volunteer organization. So everything is done on, you know, wow, from the good hearts of the members. Yeah.
That is incredible. And could you share a bit more about you've started sharing a bit about that, but what are some of the main struggles, I guess, for Filipino women, firstly back in the Philippines, but then also Filipino women who have moved over here?
Yeah, so in the Philippines, of course, at the moment, we have a president who is the son of the dictator, and a lot of killings, extrajudicial killings like that are happening to activists and even to non-activists who are just, you know, trying to organize themselves within their communities. So they are being silenced, and the poverty and that is a result of the very corrupt government is just through the roof. So the cost of living crisis there is just unimaginable at the moment. Mm. The daily wage is not even reaching $17.
Wow, okay. Yeah,
if you convert to Australian dollars, but that is only in the main cities. If you go further back, it goes up to around not even 10.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
And so that puts a lot of vulnerability, especially to women who are, it's every society is patriarchal, but when you talk about countries like us, which is, classified as a third world country, then, the economic problems is just so high that
Absolutely.
It puts women in almost like, if you don't have the money,
exactly,
you basically don't have anything.
And
a lot of women are not even paid the right wages, not even half of what men, receive. And we're talking about very small percentage of women that can enter the workforce, or violence against women, all the things that that. And then, of course, on top of that, we have the militarism that is being fueled by the United States government in the Asia Pacific. The plan this year is to announce that the Philippines will be the launching pad of their wars. So we have the biggest number of military bases. I think we're now up to 9 U.S. military bases. It was from 2 in the past.
So we're gonna be the first to die
with all of this.
Oh no, don't say that.
Wars of aggression that the U.S. is doing
in the
region and all over the world.
Absolutely.
But then also coming to Australia, as forced migrants, there are now 7,500 Filipinos leaving the country every day to look for work elsewhere in the world. We're located in 90-plus countries in the world.
Very widespread,
very widespread. In Australia, we're the third largest Asian community. And you can just imagine that that is very big in comparison to, say, Asia in China, where they have such a big population compared to the Philippines. So here, it's not really much different. We're facing until now, the Family Violence Safety Act of the government that was never amended. It's still 1994.
Wow.
Only covers people in terms of family violence, only covers a small number of people that are already on temporary partner visas. That means that everyone else that are not in that category are excluded from any service. I'm just talking to a woman yesterday who's having all the hard time with an 8-year-old, cannot enter even a women's refuge because he's on a bridging visa.
Yes.
So, and she's very unsafe together with that child. And that's an everyday occurrence that we get from Gabriela Steria. We get a lot of messages from our Facebook page. We don't even bother to go on other social media page because
you
we
must
just
be
don't
swamped.
Have the capacity.
Yeah, absolutely.
And other nationalities also message us.
And I love that. I love the solidarity. Thank you, Ness. Unfortunately, we don't really have much time left. Could you share briefly about the event you have coming up this Saturday? Obviously, that we'll be covering a lot of the things you've already been talking about right now.
Yeah, so we're going to have a short protest in front of the State Library, bringing to the fore all of these issues, both in the Philippines and also here in Australia. And then after that, we're going to have an educational discussion, probably around 3 hours, that talks about both the problems here in Australia and also in the Philippines, but more specifically, what happens to the women who are part of the marginalized sectors.
Thank you so much, Naz, for joining us this morning. And yeah, looking forward to chatting with you again in the future. Thank you, Naz.
Thank you. Bye for now, Pisa.
Bye-bye. That was Naz Garbanzo from Gabriella Australia in Anakbayan, Melbourne, a Filipino women's grassroots organization advocating for women and children's rights. You can find out more about them at Instagram at Anakbayan, Melbourne, or Gabriella Fils.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Up next, we have a song for you by Gamelan Dan Anda, which is a Nam-based Balinese gamelan or percussion orchestra, and together with Fire Tail, an electro jazz fusion band with South Indian Carnatic music influence. The album launch will also feature traditional wayang kulit or shadow puppetry by Ready New Gang. This is Bapang Selisir. Was Bapang Selisir by Gamelan Dan Anda as well as Fire Tail.
3CR.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, and today we are presenting a summer special highlights episode on the theme of global solidarity with the diaspora. We are taking a look back at current affairs content and discussions featured from across 2025, and as such, some of the material may be out of date. Late last week, Fong spoke to fellow 3CR presenter Carnegie about the recent earthquake in Myanmar. Kanagi is currently based in Chiang Mai, Thailand, and spoke to Fong about the impacts of the earthquake in Thailand, the communities particularly impacted in Myanmar, and the efforts of organizations and mutual aid campaigns to support those affected. This interview was recorded on Wednesday, 2nd April 2025.
Welcome back to Tuesday Breakfast, Kanagi. So nice to chat with you. Do you want to just give listeners, maybe our new listeners, just a quick rundown of who you are and what you're doing at the moment?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on Tuesday Breakfast. I'm so thrilled to be on, even if it is as a guest. So my name is Kanagi. I was a Tuesday, well, I still consider myself a Tuesday Breakfast host deep down in my heart. But I did Tuesday Breakfast for 4 years until I moved over to Thailand with my family for a little bit. And I still do Women on the Line. So I'm one of the hosts for that show as well. And at the moment, I'm just living in Chiang Mai in Thailand and teaching English.
So you're on the show today to actually talk about the recent earthquake that was recorded in Myanmar. But there were also, I mean, people in Thailand also felt the effects of that. So I was wondering if you could start by giving us a brief summary of events when the earthquake hit and in what areas.
Sure. So the earthquake hit on Friday, the 28th. Of March. It hit, well, I felt it in Chiang Mai around 1:30 p.m. And I think it hit Myanmar in the Mandalay region about 12 minutes before that. And Chiang Mai is in the north of Thailand. So we're about 800 kilometers roughly from Myanmar. So we absolutely felt it. And we had no warning, which in hindsight is, you know, I think a lot of Thai residents here have been wondering how come we didn't get that warning. Yeah, there was a 12-minute gap between Myanmar feeling it and Thailand feeling it. So when we felt it, no one was expecting it at all. And it's one of the worst. I've experienced, I think, 3 earthquakes in my life. One in Melbourne, which was just a little tremor during lockdown. And one in India in the Himalayas, which was a little bit scary because you're in the mountains. But this one was by far the most intense and the longest lasting one that I've ever felt. It kind of just felt like it went on and on, which was terrifying. And I think in past earthquakes, once you kind of get out of like where you are and you go out into the street or an open area, you start to stabilize a little bit. Whereas here, that wasn't the case at all. Like the roads were moving, cars were moving, trees, power lines, everything was swaying so visibly. And it went for so long that I think people are still trying to get their like stability and bearings back. So yeah, that was kind of what the experience was like. Very sudden and quite extreme.
Yeah. So given that description of the initial earthquake that you just described, what do you know about the damage in Myanmar and also in Thailand? Like how widespread is it?
So in Thailand, weirdly, Bangkok felt it a lot more than Chiang Mai, even though they're much further from Myanmar. But I've read that that has to do with the fact that Bangkok is built on soft soil, which is really interesting. And the direction in which the crack happened, which sort of went more towards them than us. I'm sure a lot of listeners would have seen that high rise that collapsed in Thailand. Obviously, Bangkok has a lot of high rises. So they sort of experienced that at a much greater scale. Chiang Mai has much smaller buildings. It's a much smaller town. So while we did definitely feel it and we can still see cracks in buildings, heaps of big residential buildings have been evacuated. I don't think the damage is anywhere near as bad. I think the residences near the river in Chiang Mai were more impacted because of the soil. And it's a bit of a shame because they were also just impacted by really severe floods a few months ago. So I think Chiang Mai has been through it a little bit. It's not being reported on much at all. I think a lot of the reporting is focused on Bangkok, which is fair enough. But yeah, it's definitely has been felt, the effects here. Myanmar is absolutely devastating because I think, so from what I've read, Myanmar is on a major fault line. And so they get quite a few earthquakes. But just because of the general levels of poverty there and the civil war that's been going on in and amongst just, you know, years of political unrest, nothing has ever been built or nothing is ever there's not much being done to prevent damage, even though they are facing this quite a bit. And so when this happened, it was in the middle of political unrest. The military coup happened in 2021. And so since then, things have been just volatile. And so this has really, really, really devastated Myanmar. And we're seeing news every day. I think that as of today, they're saying the death toll could exceed 3,000, which is massive. And then I've also seen other media outlets say that it could end up in the 10,000s. So yeah, every day it's the news coming out of Myanmar is absolutely devastating. It's been a state of emergency. And I think for me, the most devastating part is that we're seeing news come out of there saying that rebels are saying that the military is continuing to conduct airstrikes, which is very hard to hear. You know, it's your own people at the end of the day. They're being devastated by a natural disaster. So yeah.
I guess you were just talking just now about how Myanmar has been impacted in multiple ways, but I guess with the earthquake as well, how things have intensified there. Do you know of any particular groups or communities in Myanmar who have been impacted the most with the research that you've been doing and the news that's been coming out of there?
I think at the moment, the news is sort of focusing just on an overall impact. What I've heard from on the ground aid workers and NGOs that are working in the sector is, as usual, the more marginalized groups are the most impacted. Women, in particular, in the more poor regions, are incredibly impacted. And there's really great on the ground NGOs doing work that's specifically supporting women because of this. Other than that, I mean, there's not much reporting on it, but I would hazard a guess that it's the groups that are most persecuted. And I think that's why there's not much reporting on it. And I think that there's a high likelihood that we won't hear about a lot of those casualties, which is similar to another thought I had about the tower collapse in Bangkok, because there's no reporting on this either. But what I know to be true is that a lot of people that work on the construction sites in Thailand are migrant workers, and they can be undocumented. And I don't think that the numbers of injuries and the death toll from that collapse are necessarily taking those people into account. And so I hope that does happen. I hope that those people are accounted for and treated with the same respect as everybody else. But yeah, I think as news comes out of Myanmar, mostly through on the ground workers and NGOs will know more.
You've already touched on what it's been like in Bangkok and Chiang Mai, but I was wondering if there was anything else that you wanted to comment on in terms of things that you've either experienced or witnessed through the news in relation to the earthquake or the impact of the earthquake in Thailand.
So for me, I was at a play center with my 2-year-old, and we were just sitting on the ground playing with these little wooden toys, and there's kids and parents everywhere, and there's a little ball pit, and all of a sudden I was like, I have severe vertigo, I am going to pass out. And I looked around, and the ball pit was like the balls were swaying in and out. And I was like, oh, no, this is an earthquake. And it's like everyone cottoned on in the same like 5 seconds, and where everyone just scooped up their kids and ran into the street. And I mean, in Chiang Mai, there's a lot of the infrastructure is not great in terms of there's a lot of open power lines everywhere. And in Australia, what would be considered like severe hazard. So that was a little bit confronting to run out into the open, but then have all those hazards kind of right there, like swaying back and forth. Yeah, so that was my own experience of it. And it went on and on and on. And we just stood there and watched these things like swaying. And I'm like, okay, if a tree falls into a power line, like, you know. Yeah, so that was my experience of it. I think like there's been really varied experiences. My friend's dad in Bangkok, who lives there, is from there, got stranded at work and had to walk like hundreds of kilometers back. Like he had no option but to do that. I think the government ordered all the public parks in Bangkok, or many of the public parks in Bangkok, to stay open overnight because people are really scared to sleep in their houses. A lot of them obviously live in apartments, and they ordered like live music at a lot of these parks to kind of quell the panic. Like I was saying, in Chiang Mai, a lot of the taller residential buildings have been evacuated, and you can, when you drive past, you can see these massive cracks, which is still a bit scary. And yeah, people are still reporting like not feeling very steady, feeling like dizzy spells. And you kind of don't realize that when you go, when you experience something that simultaneously feels really long but really short. And then like 5 days later, I'm like, why do I feel like I was just on a cruise ship? Like, it's a really strange feeling. Yeah, so I think people are still quite scared. I think there was 72 or 73 aftershocks in Thailand. So I think people are still on extremely high alert for those. There was an aftershock in Myanmar that was at a 5.1 magnitude, which is basically another earthquake. So everybody's still incredibly on high alert, and I don't think people are like wanting to leave their families and friends for very long. So yeah, it's definitely had its impact on people.
Yeah, and so for people in so-called Australia who are watching this happen and they want to be able to support people on the ground, communities being impacted in Myanmar, do you know of any mutual aid campaigns and organizations that people can donate to, either locally or as in so-called Australia, that where people are organizing, or in Myanmar, in Thailand, to support the efforts?
Absolutely. So Better Burma is a great not-for-profit organization. They have a GoFundMe for emergency relief. You can follow them on Instagram at Better Burma, and they have all the links in their bio, or you can just Google Better Burma GoFundMe and it'll come up. And the other one is Sisters to Sisters, which is a US charity working with on the ground workers who are women and youth in Myanmar. And they have, they're raising funds specifically for things that impact women, so reproductive care and menstrual hygiene. They have so much information on their website and on their socials. You can find them on Instagram at sisters2sisters.myanmar. And yep, they've got QR codes that you can donate with, links, and they're great. So please go and donate to these two charities if you have the means. I also can provide mutual aid information that you could maybe include in your show notes for anyone who's interested.
Yeah, that sounds so great. Thank you so much. And yeah, for listeners out there, we'll include all of the links and information that Carnegie just told us about in our show notes after the program. So you can head online at 3cr.org.au/Tuesday-breakfast. But for now, thank you so much, Carnegie, for joining us on the show. We miss having you on Tuesday Breakfast. But yeah, thank you for giving us an insight into what it's been like in Thailand after the earthquake in Myanmar, and I guess the ongoing efforts to support communities and rebuild after this event.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Carnegie speaking to Fong about the earthquake that hit Myanmar and Thailand on Friday, 28th of March. To donate to the organizations and mutual aid funds mentioned in the interview, head to our website after today's show for more details. Carnegie is one of the presenters of 3CR's Woman on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
3CR's summer programming. This summer, 3CR Breakfast is featuring extended special event recordings and selected interview highlights from the past year, as well as new summer culture or music-themed breakfast shows curated by our current affairs breakfast teams. Stay tuned to 3CR, and we look forward to returning to our regular programming in January.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, and today we are presenting a summer special highlights episode on the theme of global solidarity with the diaspora. We are taking a look back at current affairs content and discussions featured from across 2025, and as such, some of the material may be out of date. You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast 3CR on the 8th of April 2025. Up next, we're going to have Pippin Jamson on. Pippin Jamson is a PhD student based in Melbourne, deeply engaged engage in research and grassroots activism. Since 2024, she has been co-organizing Melbourne Bergera, a collective of Indonesian students and workers committed to building solidarity and resistance. The group advocates for anti-militarism and social justice in Australia and Indonesia. Good morning, or selamat pagi, Pipin. How are you today?
Good morning. Selamat pagi. Good. How are you?
Yes, good to hear from you again. Thanks for joining us so early in the morning. How are you going today?
Good.
Preparing
for the next action.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, we should get into that today. I guess to start us off, a bit of background, could you tell us what's been unfolding, I guess, in Indonesia? Because we know there's quite a bit going on. It started with the austerity protests and then obviously the recent military laws that has been quietly brought in and that has led to another surge in the student protests again. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, since early 2024, actually,
we've seen
a surge in student-led protests across Indonesia in response to the deepening authoritarianism, especially the erosion of democratic norms during and after the national election in 2024. In fact, in Melbourne, we also started to organize Melbourne Bergerak.
Yes.
Based on that issue, because we're outraged by the manipulation of electoral processes, the weakening of the anti-corruption body, and also increasing repression towards the students, and also not only the students but also the lots of indigenous people in regards to land grabbing and land conflict. So Indonesia is basically currently experiencing a significant democratic backslide with growing sign of authoritarianism as what we know that nowadays Prabowo, the president, he actually was a former general linked to serious human rights violation, including during the 1998 exactly. And the occupation of East Timor. And he is also the son-in-law of former dictator Suharto, whose regime was responsible for the deaths of millions during 1965.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess you mentioned it. You're part of a collective called Melbourne Bergera, and you advocating for anti-militarism and social justice in Australia as well as Indonesia. Could you tell us more about the group and the work you guys do?
Yeah, Melbourne Bergerak is a collective of Indonesian students, workers, and activists based in Victoria. So we organize across issues that connect the struggle back home with broader global injustices as well. And therefore, we've also mobilized in solidarity, not only related to Indonesian issues, but also in relation to the Palestinian right.
Exactly.
And also demand to stop ceasefire and cut any ties with the university, because lots of students also have been involved in free Palestine movement here as well.
Yeah.
So we see ourselves as part of a transnational network of resistance.
Beautiful, yeah. Yeah, and I noticed that it's not just Melbourne Bergera. Like, so there's an Amsterdam Bergera, I think there's a Toronto Bergera. There's a few, basically like the same Indonesian group activists in a lot of capital cities across the world. Is that right?
Yep, so true. So we have a network in London.
Yeah.
It's called London Bergera.
Yes.
And also in New York, Europe, Taiwan. And also in Indonesian countries as well.
Yeah, and I saw that the group recently posted that you guys are doing a bit of political education. Is that right?
Yes, correct.
What is what do you think is the importance of that kind of work? Because obviously, you know, earlier on today we had Brenda from Extinction Rebellion, and she spoke about, you know, the importance of imagination and creativity when it comes to civil disobedience. But what do you think about the role of things like that, sitting together in a room and talking about the political education side of things?
Yeah. So the first thing is that we had a vacuum, like 32 years during Suharto authoritarian regime. There has been like huge depolitization, and also they call it as the normalization of campus life. So lots of element of people are actually depoliticized. Systematically. So that type of we call that class politics. So it's basically a political education to discuss about the history. So we are not going to be taken away one more time from our own history. So that's the reason.
Yeah, and that's so incredibly important, isn't it? Because, I mean, I'm originally from Singapore. It's the same thing. And it's that erasure of history. It's the collective amnesia that allows us to become de-radicalized because we forgot what happened to us, or we were just not told. It's just intentionally removed and erased from our education systems for that very reason, to keep us obedient and well-behaved.
Exactly.
What do you think is the role of, I guess, you spoke about it, about this transnational movement. What's the role of those in the diaspora when it comes to activism? So you're not in Indonesia yet, you're fighting for Indonesia, right? So what do you think, what's the impact you think you could have in this sense?
Yeah, that's a very important point that you raised, Riza. Yeah. So being physically away doesn't mean being politically disconnected.
Absolutely.
That's what we are trying to underline, the role of diaspora when it comes to activism. In fact, we are in a unique position actually to amplify struggles in Indonesia while also confronting the system of power here when we talk about the colonialism.
Exactly.
Decolonialism.
It's all connected.
We still have, like, of course, we live under capitalism, and also specifically in Indonesia, the rising militarism, because in Prabowo's cabinet, the military again expanded into civilian sectors. And so the diaspora can act as a pressure point, especially in moments when local activists face repression, so that we can build bridges, raise awareness, and hold institutions accountable, actually.
Absolutely, and grow that solidarity. And of course, well, we probably could talk about this all day, because obviously Australia's complicity as well and very close ties to Indonesia is something worth unpacking. But unfortunately, we've got to wrap it up a little bit. But I do want to give you time to talk about the action you're planning to hold this Thursday. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so this action on Thursday, the 10th of April, we will be holding an action outside the Indonesian consulate. It's called Aksi Kamisan. It's literally translated as Kamisan, Thursday action. So Aksi Kamisan or Thursday action is a weekly silent protest held every Thursday in front of the presidential palace in Jakarta, where victims and families of victims of human rights violations will be alive and wear black and hold black umbrellas as symbols of mourning and resistance. And it started in 2007.
Okay.
So our action in Melbourne will be the first time Thursday action or Aksi Kamisan. We are also bringing this spirit of resistance into the diaspora. So we actually carry three urgent demands.
Yes.
The first one is stop military intervention on campus, as what I mentioned earlier, and repeal the Indonesian military law that just passed earlier this year, and also reject the revision of the police law, which extends cyber surveillance and uses the rhetoric of national security to silence public dissent. So that's exactly the same situation that we're facing in on Melbourne.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Pippin. Thanks for joining us today. And yeah, we'll look forward to hearing from you again soon, perhaps to follow up on this and talk a lot more about, yeah, the interconnections between the struggles in Indonesia, Australia, and Palestine, West Papua, and so on. But yeah, thank you so much, Pippin. Lovely
thank
to hear
you.
From you. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Pippin Jamson from Melbourne Bergerak and UniMelt for Palestine speaking about their work advocating for anti-militarism and social justice in Australia and Indonesia. Do follow their Instagram at Melbourne Bergerak. That's at Melbourne BERGERAK to find out more about their work. You're on 3CR Tuesday Breakfast. My name is Fiza and this is a summer special episode we have curated from highlights of our show from 2025. And as such, some of the material may be out of date.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
This episode, we are looking back at speeches and chats focusing on the theme of global solidarity with the diaspora, featuring voices from the Philippines, Sri Lanka, Singapore, and more. 3CR Tuesday Breakfast will be back to our regular program format next week. Till then, stay tuned to 3CR Community Radio. Up next, we'll be speaking to Elijah Tay. So besides Australia, last Saturday, the 3rd of May, also saw Singaporeans at the polling booth voting in the 14th general election since Singapore gained independence in 1965. This was the first election since 2001 that did not feature Lee Hsien Loong as Prime Minister, with Lawrence Wong having taken over that position as of May last year. To discuss the latest election and post-election sentiments, we are joined today by Elijah Tay from Transformative Justice Collective. Elijah is a student and community organizer in Singapore. With their comrades, they support, educate, agitate, and mobilize people on the ground through various campaigns like Stop the Killing, an anti-death penalty movement led by the Transformative Justice Collective, improved financial aid for their lower-income schoolmates via NTU Financial Aid Friends, and calling for universities to divest from Israel via Students for Palestine. Good morning, Elijah. How are you going?
Hey, morning. I'm so sleepy. It's like 6 a.m. in Singapore right now, but I'm so excited to be on this show.
Thank you so much for joining us. So I know it was so early in the morning, but yeah, I'm really excited to have you on. Obviously big news for us here in Australia with the Saturday elections, but people might not know as much about Singapore's political and election history. So I thought maybe, yeah, we could start off with maybe familiarizing them with the political climate in Singapore.
Right, yeah. So in Singapore, we've had a one-party dominance since independence, right, which is the People's Action Party. I think what a lot of people don't know is that, like, how the People's Action Party got elected in the first place, like, decades ago, was that they were led by leftist leaders, so leaders like Lim Chin Siong, Poh Soo Kai, and those were the people who brought the PAP into parliament in the first place. And they used to be the opposition party.
Exactly.
So ever since, like, they got into power, then one of the leaders at that point in time also, like Lee Kuan Yew, decided to work with the British and kick out the leftist faction of the PAP, which later formed Barisan Socialists. So so since then, like, PAP has held like supermajority in parliament. And I think actually like electoral politics, because if you look just say in 2001, the PAP won on nomination day, like it was a complete walkover,
exactly.
no contestation, given like the amount of like authoritarian interventions leading up to that, right?
Absolutely,
And in 2006, we had three opposition MPs, and after the last elections, we have 12 in parliament. So that is like some progress, although like
definitely
PAP still holds super majority.
Yes. I think whenever I share with friends here who might not be familiar with Singapore's political history, and I'll be like, oh, the People's Action Party has been in power for like 60 years, you know? And and I think thank you for that very comprehensive history, because I think people are also maybe not necessarily aware how defamation lawsuits, for example, was a big weapon, I guess, that was used against politicians and activists, especially from the in the 60s to 80s time period, and led to, of course, a lot of imprisonment.
And
obviously this is why we are only now seeing, I guess, thankfully, the growth of some kind of opposition government. So speaking about the election itself, this was the first election for this current prime minister, and quite significant, I thought, was that he has a significant social media presence, which I think speaks to both PAP's aging support base, but also the significance, I guess, of the younger generation in this election. What would you say are the concerns of the younger generation in particular going into this election?
Right. I think actually, honestly, a lot of the concerns of the younger generation don't differ too much from the general population, right? I think a lot of it has to do with the cost of living, the rising cost of living. And I think especially when it comes to things like the goods and services tax, like having increased like by 3% over the past 3 years.
And
also housing prices skyrocketing, right? Like for public housing in Singapore, which we refer to as HDB flats, right? A couple of them have risen to like $1 million, which is quite an insane price, because it's meant to be affordable
public housing
for the general population.
Yeah.
So I think like these are the main concerns, and like for university students like myself, a lot are concerned about being able to secure a job, especially one that is decently paying. And I do know a lot of friends who have like who have just graduated and are still looking for a job, or like the only offers they get are like very poorly paid or insane hours with no like overtime pay, that kind of stuff. So I think job security is a very big concern as well. And it all ties back to rising cost of living, these like material concerns.
Absolutely. It's interesting, because obviously listening to you, and early on the show this morning we had a young voter as well speaking about Australia's election results, and it's the same thing, right? We're all concerned about the same thing. And you're right that it's not specific to youths in particular, but I guess in a sense for older generations who, especially in the context of Singapore, who may have had the benefit of enjoying a rather financially successful couple of decades, things are slowing down financially, and in this age of economic turbulence and global trade wars and so on and so forth, I guess that is a concern. What would you say were the common expectations or demands that people had in this election in terms of what they wanted to see from their government, be it, you know, PAP or opposition?
Right. Yeah, I think that, like, I guess, like, a lot of people hope to see how the government would address or like, the candidates from different parties would address the cost of living issues, at least for people who are paying attention to politics. So I think the policies that were put out, like, say, for example, decreasing or like reversing the GST hike was something that people resonated with. But also at the same time, I think that like most of the Singapore population honestly just didn't care to pay attention to local politics. I think that like the perspectives that I've received, at least, like, are from people who actually care to express their opinions and like demands, right? But most people don't do that. And I think that like that is a result of decades of depoliticization, decades of like fear-mongering and increasing authoritarianism, right?
Exactly.
And so I think that like after the elections, a lot of people are very frustrated, and they're like, well, why these Singaporeans like don't vote for, like, say, for example, Andre Low in Jalan Kayu SMC, right? So there are a lot of like so much frustration against like have agency in deciding how we want to vote. But I think at the same time, like, there is decades of like authoritarian interventions that has made it difficult for people to learn how to study politics, to learn how to like engage in these topics.
And of course, yeah.
Not to excuse like the power that each vote has, but I think that like responsibility and like the anger should be directed towards the state that has like perpetuated such a strong authoritarian regime in the first place.
Yeah, I think, I guess it might be worth pointing out to our listeners that mainstream media in Singapore is very much pro-establishment, right? With the country, I remember reading, it's ranked 123rd in the world in terms of press freedom. And I guess you would be quite familiar with this, given that Transformative Justice Collective is one of the victims of this lack of press freedom. I don't know. Do you feel like you can speak to the POFMA that was imposed on TJC?
Yes. Yeah. Let me make a quick note about the state media first.
Oh yes. Please.
On that note, right. So in relation to the elections, I think that the 9-day election period. First of all, it's very insane. But the way that the duration it was called and the fact that Singapore has a cooling off day, it's really unfair, the way the scales would tip towards 100%. The PAP, right? Because the day before cooling off day this year, the 1st of May, that's Labor
Day. Yes.
But there are a lot of police restrictions that will make it difficult for an independent Labor Day rally to have happened that day. But the NTUC could hold it. So then and the NTUC and PAP, according to relationship, right? So when they have the rally the day before cooling day, and then on cooling off day, all the mainstream media is going to report is the PAP on the front covers of the papers.
Exactly.
So then there is this proportionate coverage of them, even on a day that is meant to, for according to the state, for people to just stay at home and reflect on their political choices.
Maybe
so there is that bias in mainstream coverage. But for TJC, we got POFMA direction notices from the Minister of Law and Home Affairs, Shanmugam, who issued us the most correction notices.
Yeah.
And it's also the top POFMA issuer nationwide. So we received a couple of POFMA correction direction notices, and what happens is that if you receive I think 3 counts of that, it opens up the possibility of being declared, being designated as a declared online location, which means that there are severe restrictions imposed on the platforms that we use. And that is why we haven't, for 2 years, we won't be able to use our social media platforms like Instagram, TikTok, Twitter. So we've had to close these, not shut down, but we have to keep these pages inactive. So it was quite a struggle to figure out then now what, how do we get our information out, right? And I think it at the same time was also an important a significant moment in civil society to recalibrate and think about that and figure out that actually this is a good opportunity to encourage the capacity to share. How to work differently, democratize information sharing, and I think that's what we've managed to do.
I think, unfortunately, I don't have much time left, but I did want to say that I would love to have you back to actually speak about the work that Transformative Justice does, and, the role of grassroots activism in enacting real change, not just every 5 years, which I think is also, that's another problem, isn't it? 5 years, that's a very long time to wait to
elect
a new government. But thank you so much, Elijah, for joining us today. I really wish we had more time, but I will definitely be having you back on again. So looking forward to chatting with you again.
Yes, no worries. Looking forward to. Thanks for having me. And I will wake up at 6 a.m. for you guys anytime.
Oh my God, I love you so much. Thanks, Elijah. Goodbye. You've been listening to Elijah Tay, a student and community organizer from Singapore, speaking about the recent elections in Singapore, as well as the work they do through various grassroots collectives. For more on their work, including Transformative Justice SG, which was mentioned, check out at transformjustice.sg, which is also where you'll find more information about what we were discussing earlier, which was POFMA, which refers to the Protection from Online Falsehoods and Manipulation Act 2019, a law that was passed in Singapore to supposedly combat the spread of fake news and misinformation online. Up next, we will be listening to a song by Rokia Wanda. Rokia Wanda was a popular singer and actor in the 40s and 50s in Malaysia and Singapore. This is Bulan Ditutup Awan, or The Moon Hidden by the Clouds. Was Rokia Wanda with the song Bulan Ditutup Awan. You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, and today we are presenting a summer special highlights episode on the theme of global solidarity with the diaspora. We are taking a look back at current affairs content and discussions featured from across 2025, and as such, some of the material may be out of date.
Menaha Kandasamy is a union activist from Sri Lanka and member of Ceylon Workers Red Flag Union. Menaha is part of an international campaign to pressure the Sri Lankan government, tea companies and retailers to provide better working and life conditions for tea plantation workers. And Menaha has been here in Nam to discuss labour and human rights issues in Sri Lanka, and held an event on Saturday last weekend at Balam Balam Place. And Menaha joins us on the show today to chat about these key issues facing plantation workers in Sri Lanka. But welcome to Tuesday Breakfast, Menaha.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for joining us, Menaha. For our listeners, you know, you've come here from Sri Lanka to chat about issues facing the plantation workers. Can you give us a little bit of history to, what tea plantations have looked like in Sri Lanka and what some of the issues have been?
Yeah. More than 200 years ago, it's a colonized British colonial period, thousands and thousands of workers were brought to Sri Lanka. So that time it called as Ceylon. They were brought to clean the jungles and plant coffee. So then later it became tea and rubber. So these workers are backbone of Sri Lankan economy. So what is the major problem for these workers currently? What is going on is like extreme poverty, country situation also extreme poverty, and their living condition is it's very patriarchal system in place, and they are isolated. They live inside the estate, work inside the estate, so everything inside, they don't have much connection with outside the world, outside even other Sri Lankan communities. So in this context, they are facing lots of problems. One is the cost of living is very high. Their wages very little. I will say it's for a day, $6.75 for a worker. And this worker also, they have like a big families, and their living condition extremely bad. So it's overcrowded and 10 into 10 feet. So they have to sleep, cook, eat, study, everything in that situation. And when it comes to the working place, the working condition is really terrible. Even today, it's 2025, the workers don't have toilets at workplace. They work more than 8 hours. And also, I have to say, it's a feminized sector. It's more women workers are working. So the women workers' problem are really high. So what I can just say, it's pregnant women and feeding mothers are there. There are benefits. And also, there is, when you say no toilets, young women, even men workers, can't, you know, it's workers' dignity. It's not something whether can we have or not. We can't make it as choice that toilets and health and safety is nil, as I said. So what I want to say is currently they are going through a big, big risk. So that is the companies are trying to casualize the plantation sector. Mm. Yeah, the plantation sector, actually, it's the formal sector. That means it's a check roll system. They were covered by EPF, ETF, maternity benefit, and workplace injury, the compensation, paid leave, job security, trade union rights, etc., etc. But when I say it's casualization, the workers are trying to give a small plot land to workers, ask them to, they are saying it's free, you don't need to be under anyone. Anytime you can pluck, any amount you can pluck, and you can bring your friends or family members, doesn't matter. How much you pluck, we pay for it. So that is the well-planned extreme exploitation. Because once when workers agree to this, they are going to lose all what I said, the Employment Provident Fund, Employees Trust Fund, the women workers are going to lose their maternity benefits. Not only that, feeding mothers are going to lose their, you know, feeding time, feeding break for their children, and pregnant mothers are going to lose, you know, now, before it was like they were given in the flatland to pluck tea, and now it's like, no matter.
Yeah.
Plus you got it, you have to do.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a very difficult situation, you know, particularly for the women working in the plantations. Can you tell us a little bit more, Menaha, about who the people are who are working in the plantations? Obviously, there's women working there and men. And are there also children working on the plantations?
Actually, in Sri Lanka, child labor is prohibited. They can't work. There is no children working in the plantation sector. But this situation will bring children already started, because when you casualize, when you're asking workers, you know, how much tea you are going to pluck, you are going to earn that much, then definitely, you know, extreme poverty situation, the workers will think, oh, okay, you know, we have to pluck more tea. There's no option. They will bring children into this field, right? So it is they are trapped into this situation. So in future, if they are going to specialize more, now it started, if they are going to continue, definitely, even though we have a law, government can't stop the child labor, right? So this is, there are so many evidence now itself, yeah, children are trapped into this situation. And also I want to just say, when you say this specialization, these women workers will get the plot of land, but once if they are pregnant, then if they can't work in that field more than 3 days or 4 days, and the land taken away from them and given to someone else, or they had to make sure someone plucking in that tree. So they are going to give a birth to this country, to see the new citizen going to arrive. Because of that, they are going to lose their job.
Yeah.
So the job security is going to be a big threat for them.
Yeah, no, it sounds like it's, you know, becoming more and more precarious. And yeah, as part of the Ceylon Workers Red Flag Union, what are the demands that you would like to see for the improvements to the workers' conditions?
Yeah, actually we want to say for all the comrades, workers, allies, whoever, we say no more silence, no more fear, no more lies, right? We are not just laborers, right? We are not just number of, you know, payrolls. We are builders of this nation, and we demand for future worth living, right? So we are saying stop this specialization, and whoever, you know, internationally, people can support this class struggle. This is a fight against corporate greed and caste oppression and state ignorance. And we are asking, we are not asking for charity. We are demanding justice. So join the fight, end the exploitation, defend the dignity of plantation workers. This is what we want.
Yeah, I think, you know, those are, you know, such important things, and you know, we need that across all industries. And yeah, certainly, I think, you know, getting that message out there and helping people to understand, you know, is so important, especially because Sri Lanka is the second biggest source of tea imports to Australia. So yeah, you know, we're connected here in Australia to this fight and this struggle. And yeah, in terms of how our listeners can show solidarity with Sri Lankan tea plantation workers, what steps can our listeners take?
Solidarity, actually, internationally, solidarity is very important because everybody drinks tea. So when they have their cup of tea, they can remember what is going on behind the scenes. So I think the pressure needs to be done from everywhere, to the companies and whoever, you know, connected with this production, to pressurize, to give, you know, a decent workplace environment and give a decent wage, right? And have a better life and dignity for workers.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we really appreciate you sharing all of that, Menahar. And yeah, I think, you know, it's so important to be considering this, you know, as you're saying, you know, as we're drinking tea and, you know, thinking about that international solidarity and, you know, standing up for it is so important. But yeah, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thank Thank you for giving me this space to raise plantation workers' voice. Thank you so much.
Yeah, well, no, we really appreciate you making time for us and, you know, sharing, all about your work.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. We've been speaking to Menaha Kandasamy, a Sri Lankan union activist and member of Ceylon Workers Red Flag Union, about the campaign to improve workers' rights in tea plantations in Sri Lanka, with a particular focus on how this has affected women workers.
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the apartheid-free zone movement.
You're on 3CR Tuesday Breakfast. My name is Sviza, and this is a summer special episode we have curated from highlights of our show from 2025. And as such, some of the material may be out of date. You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast on the 26th of August on 3CR 855 AM. Up next, we'll be listening to Alexia Fuentes speaking at the Pacific Peace Conference. The Pacific Peace Conference was organized by the Pacific Peace Network, which was formed in 2019. It stands on the shoulders of the nuclear-free and independent Pacific Organization formed during the 1970s to oppose nuclear tests. Representatives from Guam, Jeju, ROK, Japan, Northern Mariana, Vanuatu, Philippines, Hawaii, Australia and New Zealand have held a range of events and actions over the past 3 years, focusing on military activity and exercises rehearsing for war. We will now listen to Alexia Fuentes, Secretary General of Bayan Australia, a multi-sectoral alliance of progressive Filipino mass organizations campaigning for peaceful independence. Speaking on the panel, Regional War Preparations Talisman Sabre AUKUS and the Force Posture Agreements, Alexia discussed the rising militarism in the Indo-Pacific, focusing on the Philippines as well as USA's strategic interests in the region, and the people's resistance against global imperialism.
So, welcome everyone. Magandang umaga po sa inyo lahat. My name is Alexia. I am the Secretary General of Bayan Australia, or Bagong Alyansang Makabayan, New Patriotic Alliance in English. We are a broad multi-sectoral alliance of progressive national democratic mass organizations of Filipinos from the Philippines, with various chapters and presence across the world and the diaspora. Today, I'll be sharing about the rising militarism in the Indo-Pacific with a focus on the Philippines under the intensifying hand of US imperialism. The Philippines is increasingly being transformed into a frontline staging ground for Washington's strategic interests in the region. But this isn't just about bases or drills, it's about sovereignty, people's lives, and global resistance. So we will walk through the broader global militarist context, the internal conditions in the Philippines that make this possible, and the specific developments, military agreements, the Edgar base expansion, Subic Bay militarization, and the joint war drills like Balikatan and Kasanga, and we'll end by highlighting the people's resistance and the urgent role of international solidarity. The Indo-Pacific has become central in US war planning. Amidst the war in Ukraine, genocide in Gaza, and tensions over Taiwan, the US is laying the groundwork for a confrontation with China. The Philippines is being positioned as a key proxy and military outpost in this inter-imperialist conflict. This isn't peacekeeping, it is war preparation. And this cannot be stressed enough. We need to call it out. We are witnessing a deepening global conflict landscape driven largely by US imperialism. Around the world, tensions are escalating. In Eastern Europe, the US and NATO continue to expand arms supplies to Ukraine while pushing NATO's reach eastward, prolonging the war and risking direct confrontation with Russia. In West Asia, the US provides full military and diplomatic backing to Israel's genocidal war in Gaza, fueling regional instability and triggering growing anti-imperialist sentiment across the Arab world. In East Asia, the US is escalating tensions with China through its provocations over Taiwan and the South China Sea, using alliances like AUKUS and Quad to militarize the region. North Korea and South Korea have increased missile tests and defense posturing largely in response to intensified US military exercises in the peninsula. diplomatic tensions are rising. The US is applying pressure on countries across the global south, especially ASEAN nations, through economic blackmail, threatening higher tariffs, trade barriers, and sanctions unless they align with US policies. Washington is pushing nations to take sides in its strategic rivalry with China, undermining regional efforts at neutrality and cooperation. All the while, the U.S. continues to provide massive military aid packages, over $3.8 billion annually to Israel, $14 billion to Ukraine, and increasing military funding and support to the Philippines. In 2023 and 2024, the U.S. earmarked over $100 million in military aid to the Philippines and urged it to increase defense spending beyond its growing budget. This year's national defense budget in the Philippines rose to approximately 256.1 to 271.9 billion Philippine pesos, or 4.4 billion to 4.7 billion US dollars, rising 6 to 12% annually, and an official push to allocate 2% of the GDP to defense, amounting to over 419 billion Philippine pesos, or 8 billion US dollars, much of it going to acquisitions aligned with US strategic interests. Now, this is not accidental. It is coordinated, and the U.S. uses the threat of conflict and coercion to militarize allied nations, turning them into proxy agents for its global agenda. The Philippines, bound by colonial legacy and economic dependence, is a prime target in this global war machine. The semi-colonial and semi-feudal roots of subservience is the backdrop to all of this on why the Philippines is so open to foreign military occupation. Because it is a semi-colonial and semi-feudal society, politically independent in form but subordinated in practice to foreign imperialist control. Economically backward, dependent on foreign capital and ruled by a landlord elite, U.S. imperialism, bureaucrat capitalism, and feudalism form the root of our problems. These conditions enable U.S. troops, bases, and weapons to be placed on our soil. Now, these social ills enable and justify foreign troop presence, base building, and arms trade under the guise of security. The Philippine state remains a puppet regime, facilitating U.S. military goals at the cost of national sovereignty and people's welfare. U.S. imperialism maintains this structure to serve its economic and strategic interests. The Philippines is kept export-oriented and import-dependent, producing cheap raw materials like minerals, coconuts, bananas, and sugar, while importing costly finished goods and technologies. We become a dumping ground for surplus goods from developed countries, undermining local industries and agricultural self-sufficiency. Filipino labor is commodified and exported through the labor export policy, making OFWs, or overseas Filipino workers, a key source of remittances while preventing national development. This dependency sustains feudal land ownership and bureaucrat capitalism, where local elites enrich themselves by serving foreign interests and blocking structural reform. As a result, our economy remains underdeveloped, our people impoverished, and our sovereignty compromised. In this context, U.S. militarization finds fertile ground. Foreign troops and bases are justified as protection, while in reality they reinforce the same exploitative order. Now, the Philippines has a few U.S. military agreements. The U.S. maintains control through three core military agreements, such as the Mutual Defense Treaty, which was signed in 1951. This Cold War-era treaty obliges both the U.S. and the Philippines to support each other if attacked. In practice, however, it has always been one-sided, justifying permanent U.S. presence and interventions in Philippine affairs, while the Philippines is expected to act in alignment with U.S. strategic aims. The second one is the Visiting Forces Agreement, or VFA, signed in 1999. The VFA allows U.S. troops to enter and operate the Philippines for joint exercises and training. It skirts the 1987 constitutional ban on foreign bases by classifying U.S. presence as visits. It grants exterritorial rights to U.S. troops, limiting Philippine jurisdiction and accountability over foreign soldiers committing crimes on local soil. Now, the third one is the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, or EDCA, which was signed in 2014 but expanded in 2023. EDCA allows the U.S. to build and operate within designated Philippine military bases. While technically not defined as permanent U.S. bases, these agreed locations are under full operational control of the U.S., effectively serving as a permanent outpost for pre-positioning weapons, launching operations, and deploying forces rapidly across the region. These agreements were designed to preserve US strategic dominance while eroding Philippine sovereignty. They effectively circumvent constitutional safeguards, facilitating the return of US military control without formal base status. And the recent expansion to 9 EDCA sites, many near Taiwan and the South China Sea, directly aligns the Philippines with US war preparations against China. The US has already poured over $82 million US dollars into upgrading these EDCA facilities, not for national defense, but to serve US logistical and military interests. These agreements don't protect Filipinos, they entrench our role as a subordinate pawn in US imperialist strategy. Recently, in June of 2025, U.S. lawmakers proposed building an ammunition manufacturing and storage facility in Subic Bay. This revives the former naval base for American logistical and combat use. This also provides a more permanent presence of foreign military assets in the country, risking national sovereignty and Filipino lives amidst increasing tensions in the region. On the other hand, the Philippine Defense Department has embraced this proposal, showing how our bureaucrat capitalist elite and puppet comprador class are complicit in ceding national sovereignty and are at complete odds with the Filipino masses and their interests, which they are constitutionally duty-bound to serve and defend. The fisherfolk group Pambansang Lakas ng Kilusang Mamalakaya ng Pilipinas, or PAMALAKAYA, strongly rejected the proposal in the U.S. Congress to establish an ammunition production and storage facility in the former American naval base. In an interview, PAMALAKAYA National Chair Fernando Hicat urged the public as well as the legislators to reject the military installation that will make us a target of U.S. rival countries that pose potential threat to the national security and to the livelihood of Filipino fisher folks. We have already removed U.S. military bases from our soil. We are concerned that their renewed presence is aimed at using the Philippines as a strategic location for provocative actions against China, Hicat added. Now, we also have several military drills, annual military drills, being hosted in the Philippines. We have the Balikatan 2025 being the biggest ever, having over 17,000 combined troops, involving troops from Australia and other international observers. Advanced weapon systems like Typhon and Nemesis were deployed for the first time, simulating war scenarios directly near Taiwan. These drills are not neutral. They normalize and rehearse for real future conflict. The U.S. is deploying its Navy Marine Expeditionary Ship Interdiction System, or Nemesis, armed with naval strike missiles along the strategic coastlines of the Philippines near the West Philippine Sea. The deployment of the U.S. Marine Corps' new land-based anti-ship missile systems, as well as other assets, including the Typhoon weapon systems and other organic ground-based air defenses used in the war games, only stoke further tensions and worry in the region, especially with worries that they may be left as a permanent fixture. And according to several news outlets, these weapon systems, strategically positioned along the Luzon Strait, are capable of reaching and hitting mainland China. Balikatan was also soon followed by the annual Kasanga Joint Australia-Philippines Military Exercises, where the ADF committed troops to be deployed to the Philippines in lockstep with the U.S. U.S. personnel and weapon systems utilized in these war games are also often instrumental in counterinsurgency operations against Filipino revolutionaries and civilians in the countryside, including peasant and indigenous communities resisting militarization of their ancestral lands. Not long after, of course, they have also launched the Talisman Sabre exercises here in Australia and Papua New Guinea to further expand the regional war preparations and containment of China under the auspices of the U.S. So we have to ask, who pays the price for all of this? It is the Filipino people who suffer, communities are militarized, indigenous and peasant farmers are displaced, and activists are red-tagged and attacked by the state. Environmental destruction follows every base construction. These costs are invisible in headlines, but deeply felt on the ground. According to Asia Pacific Research Network, in April 2023, activists and humanitarians who came from a consultation with communities on U.S. military bases were harassed by the Philippine National Police, and the activists include church worker Agnes Messina, who was also illegally detained in 2022 after a humanitarian mission in shelled villages in Gonzaga. A fact-finding mission led by the peasant group Dangayan Cagayan Valley was also barred from the armed forces of the Philippines from visiting the town of Asinga via Bagao, Cagayan, a campaign center for peasant farmers Tanggol Magsasaka or Defend Farmers, reports that similar patterns of harassment were employed against first responders who investigated the bombings in Gonzaga, Cagayan in 2022. Meanwhile, government-affiliated online trolls attacked and threatened those who joined the massive demonstration against US bases in Tuguegarao on April 18, 2023. Residents of Cagayan expressed their opposition to the province, serving as a staging area for an impending US-China clash. There are many more incidents we can cite which involve various human rights abuses and cases of harassment involving the presence of US troops and other personnel, as well as state security forces who protect these military activities at the expense of human rights and welfare of the Filipino people. We cannot also forget, of course, the Subic rape case of Nicole versus Daniel Smith, or the rape slay of Filipina transwoman Jennifer Laude at the hands of US serviceman Joseph Scott Pemberton. In both cases, the US stepped in and absolved the perpetrators with the Philippine government, allowing them to eventually return to the US despite the ongoing trial and public outrage as Filipinos clamored for justice. US imperialism is the number one threat to peace. We have to be clear about this, and it does not simply respond to regional and global conflict, it engineers it. The US provokes and sustains wars to secure markets, extract resources, and dominate geopolitical rivals. It creates dependency through military aid, trade conditionalities, and basing agreements. It deploys fear and instability as tools to justify arms buildup and foreign intervention. In the Philippines, the US military presence means being drawn into future wars, particularly with China. Continuing economic subordination through defense-centric spending, enabling state repression through militarized governance. This is not defense, it is occupation, and it must be opposed. The people resist, but we resist and we will continue to resist. From Bayan to ILPS, or the International League of People's Struggles, from the homeland to the diaspora overseas, from the legal mass movements to the revolutionary forces in the countryside, Filipinos continue to oppose EDCA, VFA, and all imperialist impositions. In cities, we mobilize through protests, education campaigns, and legislative lobbying. In rural areas, organized peasant and indigenous communities resist land grabbing and forced displacement due to militarization. Filipino youth organize to expose how militarism threatens education, jobs, and national development. The people demand genuine land reform, national industrialization, and an end to foreign basing, and a sovereign foreign policy rooted in peace and people's rights, not imperialist dictates. International solidarity is also key. Your solidarity matters. Australians must oppose ADF's participation in war games like Kasanga and Talisman Sabre, question the militarization of the region, and resist AUKUS and Quad. We must challenge the logic of war being sold to us as security. We call for churches, unions, peace activists, and First Nations movements to support Filipino communities in struggle and develop stronger relations and mutual solidarity across the region. The fight for Philippine sovereignty is part of the broader global resistance to imperialism, militarism, and neocolonial control. International solidarity strengthens the people's struggle and helps isolate and defeat imperialist aggression. In June, an international conference on imperialism and wars of aggression was held in the Philippines. It was organized by various organizations from different countries that met together for stronger coordination to align strategies and promote collective action and solidarity. From this conference emerged the idea of a peace caravan. This peace caravan will be a series of internationally coordinated protests in September later this year. To conclude, US imperialism is preparing for war, not peace. The Philippines and the region are being militarized at a dangerous pace, but people are resisting, and we must stand together for sovereignty, for justice, and for genuine peace. Thank you, Mabuhay ang Sambayan ng Pilipino, long live international solidarity, and down with US imperialism. Let us stand together to defend peace and people's sovereignty across the world. There can be no genuine peace without justice, and no justice without national liberation. Maraming salamat po, and thank you.
That was the incredibly inspiring Alexia Fuentes, Secretary General of Bayan Australia. Alexia was speaking on the panel of regional war preparations at the Pacific Peace Conference and discussed the rising militarism in the Indo-Pacific, focusing on the Philippines as well as U.S. strategic interests in the region in particular. And yeah, an incredibly powerful call for the rise of people's resistance against global imperialism.
This deal really accentuates and is very complementary to the White Australia domestic policy. Here you have not only a white alliance, but an Anglo-Saxon alliance of the ultimate cultural allies of the United States banding together, and the significance that it is aimed at colored peoples, at Asian peoples, at Pacific peoples. This is injecting a horrible racial dimension to this conflict. So I think the U.S. and Australian elites' racist military policies are complementing the increasingly racist domestic policies. So I think, therefore, we really have to look out very, very carefully at this very dangerous synergy between racism on the military front and racism on the domestic front.
Subscribe to 3CR. Where else can you hear radical news, analysis, music, and opinions? Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 03 9419 8377.
Thank you for joining us on this special summer episode of Tuesday Breakfast, featuring highlights from the past year. My name is Fiza, and I've curated this special episode on the theme of global solidarity, featuring guests from Indonesia, Sri Lanka, Myanmar, and beyond. The 3CR Tuesday Breakfast team will be back to our regular show format next week. Until then, do check out the following events happening across this week. This Thursday at 9 p.m, join the Loud Jew Collective for an online webinar discussing justice, safety and compassion in light of the Bondi terror attack. With Invasion Day coming up, there will be banner painting sessions this Saturday, 1 p.m. at Catalyst Social Centre in Coburg, as well as on Sunday, 11 a.m. at Balam Balam Place in Brunswick. And lastly, for a bit of music for a good cause, there's Gathering for Gaza this Saturday at 2 p.m, a fundraiser gig featuring Miss Kanina, Yara, Genesis Owusu, and so many more. For more details on these events, do check out Friends of the Earth Melbourne socials. Up next is Accent of Women here on 3CR Community Radio.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.